out the way and let your light, let your love show. It's a sure ride down a long road. When the rains come and the winds blow, let your light shine wherever you go.
That was Keb Mo. I am Moksha Lee. This is In Your Right Mind, and I welcome you to my show, airing every Monday night from 6 to 7 p.m. here at 107.3 Cows FM in Occidental, California. You can listen to us live on the web at kows.fm. You can get a webcast there. And you can call us at the station at 707-874-1073. If you'd like to be a member, go ahead and give us a call. And here on the show tonight, we've got Russell Dellman. I'm really excited to have him today. He is a great thinker. I've actually been the happy recipient of his newsletters recently and just been reading up. He's really got some amazing things to say. He teaches the Embodied Life seminars. He's a Feldenkrais practitioner. And so we're going to have him on in just a moment. And I'm just going to invite you to listen to Solfeggio. This is a heart-opening music. So go ahead and just let yourself ground and breathe and listen to Solfeggio now. Listening to this music, you can go right ahead and take some deep breaths. That's it. Just open your heart like a camera lens. Imagine yourself just taking some breaths through your heart now. And go ahead and connect yourself to the earth. You can imagine your feet growing great tree trunks. Send those roots all the way down to the center of the earth. And let yourself take up some space right now, just in this present moment. See if you can feel your heart beating in your chest now. And just take a moment to release your day. Imagine like like leaves off of a tree, all the things that you need to take care of just falling away from you. Let those leaves fall. You can just feel the sun shining on you now. Imagine the sun just shining right down on you. And just take that sunshine into your whole body. Let yourself feel replenished now. Take a couple more deep breaths. And just give yourself a moment to think of the things that you're grateful for now. Just taking another couple moments here. That's great. All right, we're going to come back to Russell Delman now. I've got him on the phone. Russell, are you there?
I'm here.
That's great. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
I appreciate the invitation.
Yes, yes. So I would love to hear more about your journey, because I think there are so many people who are trying to find their way, who are trying to find their calling. And I love to talk to people who are so obviously on their path about how they got there.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, you know, it's a mystery to me, I must say, that I was graced at a very young age, I think I was 18 years old when I read an article on Zen meditation. It was actually by Suzuki Roshi, Suzuki from San Francisco Zen Center. And it just hit something inside. I was a college sophomore, and I'd had my first broken heart. Mm-hmm. And without any kind of spiritual background in my home or any other specific influences, I was just drawn to this article. I read it and just started to meditate immediately.
Wow. You know, there's nothing like your first heartbreak to really actually motivate you, isn't it? They are brutal.
It's really true. It's like when we look at, that's kind of like a larger subject, when we say we all want what's wonderful, and of course we want what makes us happy and what brings joy and peace, and we need to be oriented towards that, and yet if we look through our life's journey, so often it's the things that we would never wish on anybody that were the major turning points.
I had a talk queued up for Pema Chodron, who talked about the value of the troublemaker.
Yeah.
Like, and what kind of gifts they really can bring to you.
Yeah, it's really this paradox, you know. Mm-hmm. We orient towards what makes us happy, and if I think of my daughter, or I think of myself, or my wife, or my students, of course, I want them to have more and more moments of joy and deep connection and peace. And then there's this paradox that so often the deepenings come because we had to deal with this illness or this loss it's such a paradoxical edge that we as human beings live on.
Yeah, and we often, you know, it's like we need that push to stretch ourselves and to grow. We like to rest sometimes in this comfort zone.
Yeah. And of course, when one is on a true path and has a sense of dedication, then my sense is that there's a kind of shifting that occurs where we recognize that everything is our path, and so we're not rejecting the difficulties, but we also cultivate this capacity for appreciation that becomes a teaching in itself. So whereas what I was just saying before is we need these kind of disappointments or difficulties to kind of motivate and push us, I think for myself and certainly for some of my students, once there is this, what we could call, in Zen we would call it a vow, a deep commitment to one's path or one's awakening or the unfolding of life, then the blessings and the I would say this shower of blessings that we're constantly offered when we're open to it, when our perception is open towards the gifts that are coming our way, they become a teaching also. So I don't want to sound like we can only learn from difficulties.
No, it's true, but I think that when you're encountering the same difficulty, like it seems like maybe a different character, but it's basically the same issue. I think you're demonstrating a commitment to a belief that you don't want to be true, but obviously if it keeps being created, there's some belief there that you want to unbelieve. So you started with meditation then.
Right, yeah. So I was 18 and took to the cushion and without a teacher for the first 5 years, just sat every day and was reading and getting some guidance from books and managed to have a practice that I think didn't go too far astray. And then when I did meet a teacher, was able to kind of hone it much more specifically. And the gift of having a meditation practice as a young man, and I was studying psychology at the time, and it was the very early days of human potential psychology and Eslon Institute and, you know, encounter and gestalt groups and all like that. So my meditation practice was complemented, I'm grateful looking back, was complemented by looking at the psychological patterns and mental patterns that were mostly unconscious in me and could come to consciousness, so that in the background there was the meditation practice, and in the foreground, at least for a number of years, was the opportunity to clarify how I was getting stuck in relationship or in certain mind states, and the complementarity of those two, of being able to work with my mental, emotional patterns, relationship patterns, while I was cultivating a deep sitting practice, dovetailed so beautifully. So again, I don't take credit for that. It really feels like grace. It feels like, how did this happen? And the third leg of that, just to be complete about it, was early on getting exposed to and a realization that working through the body, working through what originally was yoga practice and then became the Feldenkrais movement work, was an essential complement to these other two legs, we could say, the leg of meditation and the leg of inner inquiry. And that triangle, which was there by the time I was 20, is still the essence of my teaching. So in some ways, I haven't gone very far. I just hopefully have gone deeper.
That's beautiful. I agree. I think that often people ignore the body and they try and drag their body along behind them, like they're kind of mad at it, like, oh, you're slowing me down. It's
it's really such an unfortunate paradigm we've been raised in, where this mind is separate from this body, and the impression that we can somehow, if we get clear enough of mind, whether it's an intellectual tradition or even many spiritual traditions, we can somehow control the body, push it along, push the machine along, or get the machine to serve us better. But without a deep respect for the wisdom and the direct connection to nature and to natural wisdom that we have, that we are living in and through. And that is such an unfortunate misperception of most people, I would say, and unfortunately even most spiritual traditions that I see.
I agree, and I think that the body holds a lot of raw emotion, a lot of shadow. And so it's very easy to kind of like maneuver yourself around with your intellectual business, whatever you think, right? And you can make your whole spiritual practice a very intellectual exercise, but your body actually isn't going to lie.
Right. Yeah, so I have so deep intention with my own inner work and with the people I get to work with, that we recognize all these layers, we could say, that there is living in our belly. There is a deep knowing, a kind of actually a brain and a source of wisdom. And in our hearts, there is another kind of wisdom. And in our heads, another kind. And they're all essential for our wholeness.
Mm-hmm.
And when they function in harmony, we tend to function well in life. And when any of them are ignored or not valued, there's an imbalance.
Right. Yeah, and it always shows up.
yeah, and we see it in our culture. You know, we see such an imbalance. You know, if we speak archetypically, we would say that the masculine is out of balance with the feminine, with the and it becomes the negative masculine. Not because masculine is negative, but when it gets out of balance, that's how it functions. And so there tends to be this attempt to dominate nature. And whether we're dominating our body or dominating the earth, it's the same impulse coming from the same place in the human being, basically a place of fear of the feminine.
Oh, that's beautiful. All right. We're going to take a break now. I've got Jimmy Cliff sitting in limbo.
Right.
I thought you might. I had a feeling you might like that one. So we'll be back with Russell Doman. And I'm Moksha Lee. This is In Your Right Mind.
But I know it won't be long. Sitting here in limbo, like a bird without a song. To roll, sitting here in limbo, got some time to search my soul. Well, they're putting up resistance, but I know that my faith will lead me on. I don't know. Show me what I know, what I've seen. Tried my hand at loving. for the tide to flow. Sitting here in limbo, knowing that I have to go. Well, they're putting up resistance, but I know that my fate will lead me on. I can say what life will show me, but I know what I've seen. I can say where life will lead me, but I know where I've been. Tried my hand at love and friendship, but all that is past and gone. This little boy is moving on.
Jimmy Cliff with Sitting in Limbo. I'm Moksha Lee. This is In Your Right Mind at Cows FM 107.3 in Occidental, California. And Cows Community Radio wants to thank Prinusky Chatham for their generous support. Prinusky Chatham provides environmental engineering solutions from science through construction. For more information, go online to pcz.com or call 824-4600. All right, and here we are with Russell Delman on a better landline, a new improved landline. Great. Thank you. So, you know, you had mentioned Feldenkrais, and you are like a leading expert on it. So I would love to hear about your approach and how you teach others about this art. What is it about?
Great. Yeah. Great. Yeah. So let me start with just my great gratitude to have met Moshe Feldenkrais back in the 70s. He was very influential on my young life. I met him when I was, I think, 22 or 23 years old. So I had been teaching yoga at the time and heard from a friend I respected quite a bit that Moshe Feldenkrais, that's not a T at the end. A lot of people say Feldenkrais. It's not a religion. It's Feldenkrais. He was a man from the Ukraine who lived most of his life in Palestine and then Israel. And he had a unique understanding of how the human nervous system learns and how we can learn through movement not only new patterns of movement, but actually new patterns of thought and of relationship. This is quite a radical insight that he came to back in the 40s. He had actually been a physicist and an engineer, so this was like a radical shift. He was also one of the highest-ranked Caucasians in judo in the world.
Wow.
So he really knew movement from his body. He knew also about physics and engineering and how gravity worked on moving beings and all like this. But what was truly unique about him was having a very early insights into how the nervous system forms patterns. And almost all of his intuitions have now been confirmed by new neurological studies and neurological techniques and all the functional MRIs and all like that. So he really saw that if you don't try to force the human being in traditional exercise, you know, repetitive practice, but actually bring awareness and bring movement into slow, Slow patterns where you pay attention to your breathing, to how you're mobilizing yourself, that the nervous system would actually form new patterns that could be repeated. And he took his insights and developed literally thousands of movement lessons. These are called awareness through movement. Mm-hmm. And they work with, sometimes we'll work with top athletes or dancers, and sometimes we'll be working with brain injured people. Mm. And it's quite remarkable that the same kinds of movement lessons can be effective for such an incredible range of people.
Mm-hmm.
So I studied with him back in the mid 70s and was authorized as one of the first Feldenkrais teachers in the country. And that was my dominant professional identity for probably close to 30 years, where I would have my own private practice. Feldenkrais teachers work both in this group movement form and also privately, using their hands to help the nervous system learn patterns of movement. So someone would have their clothes on. It's not like a massage. You might lie on a table, and they would gently move your body, helping your nervous system and also your awareness to sense, oh, I can turn my head like that, or I could reach with my arm like this, or I could breathe differently. And these kinds of discoveries actually lead to changes, as I said before, not only of movement, but also since we relate to the world through our bodies, if you have a different way of standing, as any director of theater would know, your carriage in the world will be different.
Mm.
Your self-image changes as your breathing changes. And this was another remarkable insight that he had. Quite early on, it's not so unusual today, but to be speaking that language back in the 40s was quite unique.
Mm.
So he developed these ways of working. The private work is called functional integration, learning to integrate the functions of the body, everything from standing to walking to breathing to reaching to anything you can think of. And then we had these group movement lessons. So I trained people in that. But I had private practice, and I trained more than 2,500 people I helped train around the world to become Feldenkrais practitioners. And while I was doing that, I was also teaching the meditation work that was so important to me, but is not intrinsic to Feldenkrais teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And also doing some of the work with the emotional life that is not intrinsic to the Feldenkrais work. So I had basically two parallel paths. I was mostly teaching Feldenkrais, and then I was also leading seminars and retreats in what I came to call the embodied life. And I started using that term in the early 90s as conveying this integration of movement, sitting meditation, and what I call guided inquiry, or looking at how you are carrying the situations of your life, how you're carrying them in thought, in communication, in bodily movement, how you're living into the situations of your life, and how you can bring awareness and therefore get some more choices.
Mm-hmm.
So I developed the embodied life work as parallel to the Feldenkrais, and then about 8 years ago, I asked myself a really important question, which was, if I had 5 years left to live, what would I be doing?
Mm.
And that's a profound question, I think, to ask probably every 5 years or so.
Right.
And what came to me was, I love the Feldenkrais work, and it's not complete for me. I really need to be spending more time doing this, the embodied life work that I was doing on the side. So I decided to stop leading Feldenkrais trainings, to limit my private practice of Feldenkrais people, and devote myself to students who wanted to take up the embodied life.
Wow.
And so that's what I do, I teach training programs in Europe and in the U.S., mostly California, and I do retreats all over in the embodied life, bringing together those three elements, the sitting, the movement, and the inquiry.
Wow. And so, you know, a lot of times when we make these big course corrections, right, or changes, some people have a lot of fear about that, the resistance, like, well, I won't make any money,
right,
or, you know, I'm going to have to change all this stuff. I don't know if I want to do that. And they kind of pine a little
bit,
right? They pine away. Oh, I wish, I wish. So what was it that helped you kind of push?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I need to reflect a little bit.
Was it a difficult transition also financially, or did you find that you kind of jumped and the net was there, like everything?
Yeah, right. Well, I commented that I felt very blessed, and I would even use the word lucky to find meditation when I did and the other parts of my path. What I think the courageous acts were probably when I was much younger in a certain way, where I didn't give any thought, you know, maybe naively, didn't give any thought to, am I going to be able to make a living at this or not? It was, you know, this was the 70s, and there was a kind of spirit in the air, especially in San Francisco, of kind of do your thing. And so I just went with it. Much, you know, I think my father was probably a little surprised that I didn't go to medical school and didn't choose a more traditional path. But I was young enough to be, naive, idealistic.
Hubris. I say hubris.
Maybe hubris, maybe stupid. But it turned out that by the time I was in my mid-20s, I was able to earn a good living as a Feldenkrais teacher. I was one of the first authorized teachers in the country. And somehow, mostly through some yoga connections and through some other people, was able to set up a practice. I actually moved to Philadelphia and created a Feldenkrais practice. And so I was able to earn a pretty good money. And then I had, I guess, another courageous decision was when Feldenkrais had his first stroke in 1982, I flew over to Israel to give him lessons, to be
to help him.
You know, kind of reverse our roles.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a major, major shift in my self-image and my capacity to have confidence in what I was bringing,
mm-hmm.
to be able to work with my teacher as a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, and then out of that, he chose me to be one of the first trainers to train other practitioners when he could no longer do that, because we had this personal relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And so that also helped me have a good income. But then the real moment, which is what I think you're really asking about, what's kind of interesting for me to reflect on, was when I decided to leave the Feldenkrais, the umbrella of the organization, because that was really 80% of my income.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a daughter who was going to be going to college soon, and this is again about 7 years ago, and I really felt like, it's time for me to step forward into the embodied life work. And I'm not sure if this is going to be able to support my family the way I have been with the Feldenkrais work. And yet there was still a kind of, I don't want to even say kind of, there was a strong, strong longing to be true to my own teaching, to my mm-hmm. own understanding. And I could have 50% of that as a Feldenkrais trainer, but not all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't like a really wild decision in that I had some money saved. I knew I could get her first 2 years of college paid. And I did have people around the world who'd been studying with me for a little while. So I had kind of a core group, but it was a significant risk to say, okay, I'm not going to have the reliability of the organization. I'm going to just step out on my own and see if the world wants to support this work.
Hmm.
So,
what was that like? Like, let's say, okay, so you make the choice, and did you feel like this? Certainly some freedom, but also did you feel like you were met with that? Was it a long gap where you're like, time for some top ramen, or was like, it just kind of worked out, you know? Like...
Yeah, I would call it a little bit of all of that.
Yeah.
So there was, it wasn't a long gap, and there were some sleepless nights, not quite sleepless, let's say waking up in the middle of the night with, This is a big step. This is a big step. Is this, you know, what happens if this happens? So I got to observe mental patterns of anxiety, how one can create anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to, of course, work with that, which became a very important learning because I hadn't really had... Well, that's not quite true. There were moments in development of my Feldenkrais practice where there was uncertainty, but now it felt stronger with the needs of a college education for my daughter, with having bought a house, all the kind of trappings of a successful life that also becomes an economically demanding life.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, so there was a period where I was breathing deeply,
mm-hmm.
deeply, and I can say I was very blessed,
mm-hmm.
that there wasn't a long gap of, oh my God, I can't pay my rent, oh my God, I'm going to have to ask my daughter not to go to that school. I didn't have to get to any edge like that, which I'm very, very grateful for.
Yeah. And I think that when you feel that strong pull, you know, when it's just like it's a calling for authenticity or something like that, right? So
mm-hmm.
I feel that when you answer that calling, that you are supported.
Yeah. You know, I think that that's really true. I when I think of my students and I think of people who are kind of at these transition points where they're trying to decide, they've been a physical therapist, and they say, well, can I really make a living as a embodied life teacher teaching meditation and movement? That's really where my heart is. But, you know, I'm so much more secure with my degree and with the work that I've been doing. And what I encourage people, I'm kind of a trust God and tie up your camel kind of person, where mm-hmm. I say, you know, it's really important that you're honoring what's living in your heart, and you don't need to make sudden, huge shifts. You can have, security is not a bad thing. It's not weak of you to also want, you know, this level of kind of guaranteed income for a while. You don't have to make it in one leap. I have concern about people who, say, take an ideology of, you know, laws of attraction or things like that and turn it in a way that I don't think it's meant to function.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think it's really great to listen to one's passion, to go toward the way the world is inviting oneself toward in a way that feels more authentic and more connected. And one can say, okay, it's okay to have this insurance or this background for that move. Especially when one has dependents.
Right.
Yeah,
I think that there are quite a few people out there who felt very maybe invalidated by the whole secret kind of ideology, where, you know, you just think you just think and keep your thoughts in that direction, of course it's going to come your way. There's hard work that makes things come your way. There's that too, right? You can work for it. And so I feel like that's important.
I like sports, and I love, you know, they're athletes who say, it's amazing how lucky you get when you work really hard.
That's right. That's right. And if it's your passion, the work should also bring you joy, like a joyful effort.
Right. And I think that's really important what you're saying, Moksha, because we have, you know, we've been raised kind of with this picture of work as being the stuff you don't really want to do, but you do it so that you can get to the play.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that such an unfortunate way to set up one's life.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that, I want to say that with respect for people who don't have currently the level of choices that have manifested in my life. So I don't want to say that out of some kind of arrogance or something, that I've been blessed that my whole life I've been able to have my work in the social realm and my work in my inner life be one work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a unique gift that, again, I don't take credit for. I think it's partially intention, partially courage, but a lot of luck also.
And I do think that there are choices you can make that can support you enjoying your life more. So if you have a job that pays so much, but you hate it, and in turn what you're doing is buying fancier cars and bigger things, and then you're stuck. Right?
So really?
You can
really
choose differently. You can say, I hate this job, but I'm going to save every penny I can and get out of here in 2 years. You can choose differently. Okay.
Yeah.
Wonderful,
yeah.
Russell. We're going to go to Pete Townsend, Let My Love Open the Door, and we'll be right back.
All right.
Russell Diamond. That was Pete Townsend with Let My Love Open the Door. I'm Moksha Lee. This is In Your Right Mind at Cows FM 107.3. I've got a PSA here. Cows Community Radio thanks Many Rivers Books and Tea for their generous support. Many Rivers Books and Tea specializes in tools for spiritual practice, including books, candles, and sacred art. Many Rivers carries fine loose-leaf teas and teawares. They also host spiritual talks and classes. It's a great little store in downtown Sebastopol, 130 South Main Street. I suggest you go on over. And you can call them if you like, 829-8871, or find them on the web at manyriversbooks.com. All right, Mr. Delman, are you there?
I am here.
Wonderful. So we were talking a little bit offline, and you had mentioned how bringing into congruence someone's inner beliefs and how and with their outer world, how those two affect each other, what the relationship is in terms of activism, in terms of what's truly important to you, and actually making that real. So I would love to, let's start that conversation.
Great. Yeah, it's really important to me. Thank you for bringing that. You know, when one has some level of insight, whether it's through meditation or prayer or through other life circumstances, the reality of our interconnectedness gets palpable. It's not a concept. It's not something that would be nice, but it's our reality that we begin to experience ourselves as cells of a larger being. And that, when one has that sense, when one has come through the trap of the trap and the gift, I would say, of the Western world, of the individual self and of the kind of worshiping of the individual, there's a gift in that. There's a beauty in that. We each have a different gift to bring to life. But it's incomplete, of course. It's the integration of the individual and the world is where our awakening and our clarity come. So what does that mean? It means, for me, how is my action, first, my way of being in ordinary situations at the post office, in the store, how is that affecting the universe? What I like to say to my students is, we are a universe, and we are a small part of a much larger universe, so that we are both a universe unto ourselves, that the whole world, we could say, are planets in our universe in which we are a central sun, and we are part of a much, much, much larger universe. And the rules that we use to interact with life become the rules of the larger universe. And so when we are in the store, when we are in traffic, when we are interacting with the world, we are literally creating how our universe functions. So the first level of interconnectivity for me is to realize that I am part of this much larger system, and how I treat others is actually how I treat part of my own body. Mm. Am I going to be respectful towards these beings, even if they're acting in ways that I wish they weren't? And being respectful doesn't mean being passive or being, like, unwilling to stand up for something. In fact, it requires standing up, but a kind of standing up that has dignity. And dignity for me means a combination of the integrity, the strength of standing on one's own feet, a grounded sense of self, and an open-heartedness.
Mm.
And my great heroes, you know, people like Martin Luther King or bless him right now, Nelson Mandela, seems to be in his last days, really show me what a human being is capable of in terms of bringing goodness into difficult situations. So the first step for me is, how do we embody our values in everyday interactions? That meditation is not for the cushion. It's for going into the store. It's for dealing with
challenging moments and wonderful moments. So that's the first level. Then the second level for me of interconnectivity is, how can I express my connection to this whole world, this whole planet, through concerns for, and you know, pick your cause, whether it's, you know, the environment, the you know, what's happening with our food system, whether it's the education of the kids, whether it's the treatment of women throughout the world, or the treatment of how we as people who have a certain power in the world, how we are making our decisions, and what kind of effect they're having, and are we thinking about those larger effects? And to find ways of enacting oneself at that level also, for me, feels very important. So that was a lot. Could you get all that?
Yeah, I did. Exactly. I was thinking about, have you been to the post office in Sebastopol?
Oh, sure.
So I don't know if you've noticed, there's a woman who works there, and she puts on one of the, you know, there's one of the booths, and she'll put on the booth the word of the day. And so the word of the day is love, or breathe, or hug, or whatever. So, and I always think about that when I'm standing in line, you know, I look for her word of the day.
Right.
You know?
What a gift, right?
It's so sweet, right? It just shifts things, you know?
It does. Well, one of the teachings that came from me young, that I somehow was able to receive, and it's become a very important part of my teaching, which is, there are always blessings occurring. If we can get out of our stories, out of our own inner obsessions, and be open to the world around us, there is always something there for us. Can I tell you a story?
Sure.
Okay, so this is a famous old Zen story that I love, but we can kind of modernize it a little bit. So traditionally, it's a monk or a nun's walking down this mountain path and going along, and hears a growl, rawr, behind. And she looks around and sees this mountain lion starting to run towards her. So she goes running to the edge of a cliff. She can't go forward. She can't go back. And she sees a branch hanging down about 4 feet down. She jumps down, grabs hold of the branch. She looks up. There's a mountain lion. She looks down. About 100 feet down, there's another mountain lion looking up. And this is what you call being in a situation, right? This is like you got to pay your rent, or your kids, you know, doing some behavior that's really difficult. This is a living situation. You're hanging by a branch. There are two mountain lions. There's no place you can go. And all of a sudden, a little mouse comes out from the side of the cliff and starts nibbling on the end of the branch, right? So we're really in a situation now. And the monk or nun looks forward and sees these wild strawberries growing out of the side of the mountain. And lets go with one hand, reaches forward, takes the strawberry, eats it, and just says, how delicious.
Nice.
And right in that moment, there is a strawberry. And I've had this experience of telling that story to a bunch of kids. I sometimes teach meditation at some Waldorf schools locally. In the fifth grade, they study the life of Buddha, and I usually tell them this. I say, but what happens next? What happens next? And I go, well, she gets another strawberry. But what happens to the mountain lions? What happens? Well, we don't really know what happens next, but I think it's going to be okay. And they're just left with that.
Right.
So I don't give them a solution. What I want to say is, even in our most harrowing circumstances, there's always a strawberry. There's always a strawberry. And, of course, the great majority of our situations are not nearly so harrowing, you know? But if we look, it's just remarkable to me the number of people who hold the door for you, even in New York City, who give you a smile when you meet their eye, even in difficult neighborhoods in, you know, Paris or in Calcutta.
Right.
The majority of people want to have kind relations with others.
Right.
And the gifts are so constant from other people, from when one opens their eyes and sees the slant of sunlight, the shadow on a street. Right now, I look out a window, and just the way this branch is blowing, if you give it not just surface attention, not just 1 second, but something like 5 to 20 seconds, it penetrates, and beauty is there, and we are touched by life.
Oh,
and that experience of being open, oh, there's a red bird just came down. if one opens to the blessings, then an amazing thing happens. One begins to live in a field of gratitude, because the natural response to being touched is, oh, thank you.
Mm.
Not because we want to be good boys and girls, but because that's the completion of the act that people do spontaneously when touched. So this movement of being available to the blessing, to the strawberry, to the gift, and spontaneously feeling that gratitude, it's what I call cultivating the field of gratitude by opening to the shower of blessings. And it's a practice. It's literally a practice that we can grow the brain states that make this kind of availability more ordinary.
Right.
And that's amazing that we, ordinary people like you and I and the people listening to this, we don't have to be extraordinary. We don't have to be sitting on a mountaintop. That we, very ordinary people, have the capacity to shift our attention so that our hearts are touched many, many, many times a day by very little things.
Right. Russell Delman, that is beautiful, and that's a great gift to part with. And we do need to part. So I want for people to be able to get in touch with you. How can people learn about your workshops and classes?
Yeah,
and
well, the best way is if they went to RussellDelman.com. So two L's in Russell, two S's and two L's, one L in Delman.com. And I've got a very full website with lots of articles. There's some free video. There's some audios. There's stories. There's a lot on there. And it also has my calendar of, I have day-long meditations in Sebastopol that are free that people can come to, and I have retreats and seminars all over California and the country and in Europe as well.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I would encourage people to sign up for the newsletter, if nothing else, because then you'll get these great little strawberries right in your in your email box, right? You'll it always seems to come at a right time. I can kind of open
that's
that
great
newsletter, and it's like, oh.
Yeah,
it's really nice. So thank you so much for
sharing
yourself
today. Yeah, thank
you
so much, Moksha. I enjoyed talking to you.
Pleasure to meet you, Russell Delman. Okay, and we're going to...
Well, bless you and bless you all who are listening.
Yeah, bless you all.
Thanks
so much. Bye-bye now.
Wasted time.